afternoon. I'm not sure good was the right adjective, but I'm very impressed to see you all here today battling the elements. It's been a horrible morning, so thank you for coming to the Lowe Institute. This is, I think, our last, no, I think we might have one more after this public event here at number 1 Bly Street, and we will in about 10 days be returning to our home at 31 Bly Street, which some of you might remember. Just up the road, just 20 steps up the road, it's our own building, so you'll be welcomed at the door by the same events team. You won't have to go through the turnstiles or jump in a lift, and we'll be really pleased to be back there in our beautiful original building. Today we welcome Professor Harsh Pant. He is one of India's most eminent foreign policy observers and commentators. This is a very interesting time for us to be hosting an expert on India's foreign policy because it's just, as you know, completed the world's biggest exercise in democracy, in which Prime Minister and leader of the BJP, Narendra Modi, was elected for a second term. This huge exercise in democratic elections with 900 million eligible voters. They voted in seven phases from 11th of April and the results were declared on the 23rd of May. So the result means that India's foreign policy will be again under the stewardship of Prime Minister Modi. His foreign policy has had its admirers but also its critics. Some believe that its foreign policy has undergone a remarkable transformation, while others argue that it's merely repackaged the policies of its predecessors. But under Prime Minister Modi, we expect that the quadrilateral alliance with Japan, Australia and the United States will be resuscitated, although Prime Minister Modi is pursuing a neighbourhood-first focus in his foreign policy, as evidenced by the first visits after his re-election, which were to the Maldives and then to Sri Lanka. There are certainly plenty of challenges for India. On the border with Pakistan, tensions escalated in February this year, triggered by a suicide car bombing and then several days later reciprocal airstrikes in each other's territory. On another of India's borders, bilateral relations with China are a balancing act. So these are no small challenges for the world's second most populous and growing nation. Professor Harsh V. Pant is Director of Studies and Head of Strategic Studies at New Delhi's Observer Research Foundation, with which we at the Lowe Institute have had a long relationship. The professor holds a joint appointment with the Department of Defence Studies and King's Institute as Professor of International Relations at King's College in London. He's also a non-resident fellow in the US-India Policy Studies at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. His current research is focused on Asian security issues, and I know he'll talk to us about that today in his discussion about the future of Indian foreign policy. He's a prolific writer. He's published numerous books on Indian foreign policy. His latest was published just in April this year on Indian foreign policy, the Modi era. And it was launched in April by India's former Foreign Secretary, Dr. S. Jaishankar. Other recent books include New Directions in India's Foreign Policy Theory and Practice, published by Cambridge University Press, India's Nuclear Policy, published by Oxford University Press, The US Pivot and Indian Foreign Policy, The Handbook of Indian Defence Policy, and many others. Professor Pant writes regularly for various Indian and international media outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, The Hindustan Times and The Telegraph. So we are really fortunate to have him here today, so please welcome him.
Thank you. Let me start by thanking Lowe for hosting me here today and for DFAT for hosting me this week here in Australia. Despite the weather, it's the conversation that matters, and I'm looking forward to an interesting conversation here and beyond on India, on the region, and of course on America's role in global politics. As I think was laid out to you earlier, we've just entered into a phase where Mr. Modi has started his second term in office. And contrary to the conventional wisdom, no one predicted it. He won with a massive landslide. It was a massive mandate, a decisive mandate, much bigger mandate than he got in 2014. Which has made him the most powerful prime minister in India over the last almost more than three decades now. Which means that there will be some very interesting shifts in Indian policy trajectory, both foreign and domestic, economic as well as social policy. Before I come to the sort of five or six strands of potential shifts in Indian foreign policy, I would just like to lay out some of the sources that, as a student of Indian foreign policy, I feel are important to understand if you are to understand where the shift or how the shift is happening in Indian foreign policy and in diplomacy. And I locate these sources at three levels. One, of course, is the most fundamental one that scholars of international relations study, this the structural level. And if you are looking at the structure of regional politics, global politics today, this is a structure that is shifting. The global balance of power is shifting, the regional balance of power is shifting, and that is posing challenges for a country like India in ways that we had not been accustomed to in the past. So where you have the rise of China as being the dominant story on the one hand, you also have another story that is now very prominent, and that is one of potential American retrenchment from the region and beyond. And I think this is a narrative that is now accepted in various quarters, in various policymaking communities, in various world, regional capitals. And this idea that America suddenly has started looking inwards, gradually but very forcefully, is something that is again a source of a shift at the structural level that countries like India are having to contend with. This is linked in some ways to this structural shift, which I call a structural shift, is this idea that economic foundations of globalization are also under challenge, that we are passing through a phase where those who had championed economic globalization, aspects of economic globalization, are now questioning the logic of that and the impact that it is having on states like India. As a result, we have institutions and norms that are under stress. So you have an entire institutional fabric that was created as part of the Bretton Woods system that is now under stress. And so one has to acknowledge that institutional framework is no longer able to respond to the structural dynamic that we are having to contend with. Then there is also a question of norms ideas about the world that are being contested much more vigorously today than they were in the past. So therefore, the rise of China, the shift in the global balance of power is accompanied by these shifts, which I think are important for nations like India to assess and to shape their foreign policy accordingly. So the question is, where does India fit in this larger structural shift, in this larger structural reality? As a rising power, India wants to enter the club. And there is contestation, there is cooperation, both with China and the US simultaneously. So therefore, structurally, India is positioned, India is getting positioned in ways that are actually very interesting to look at from the outside. As a student of international relations, as an observer of Indian foreign policy, this is a unique moment for Indian foreign policy to react to, because post-Cold War was a period in the early 1990s when India started rising. That post-Cold War phase seemed to be coming to an end. And the post-Cold War phase that is emerging might have some new challenges for India in the offing. We don't really understand those challenges, but we are aware that the assumptions of the past can no longer hold. Now, this is a larger structural shift. This is, that we often talk about, that we often discuss. But there is something also is happening at the domestic political level in India, which is, I think, important to understand for those who are looking at India from outside. This shift to the center-right in Indian politics is a shift that is very real. This is a shift that will have profound consequences for the way India operates, not only domestically, but in the world. And this is something that is not often acknowledged, that Indian polity has shifted fundamentally to the right, both in 2014 and now when you look at the election results of 2019. And this shift is very unique in Indian political history, because we have not yet seen the rise of BJP, the rise of Bharatiya Janata Party, the rise of center-right forces in Indian politics. Their manifestation, the kind of power that they represent today, was not seen in the last almost seven decades of Indian politics in the past. So this shift is accompanied by a rise of what is commonly known as an aspirational India. So this is an India that aspires, where there are new voices, there are new aspirations. This is an India that one has to go beyond Delhi, Mumbai, Calcutta, and Madras, the four metros, to understand where the power is coming from. If you see a lot of what was happening in the Indian media, in English language media throughout these elections, and how it got the fundamentals of this election wrong, I think is a tribute to the fact that you have something else going on in the hinterland that Indian traditional media was unable to capture in its assessment of what was happening at the ground level. A lot of the election analysis that you would get in the Indian mainstream media was telling you a story that Mr. Modi was under stress. But when the results came out, it was exactly the opposite, that the opposition was under stress, that the opposition completely failed in carrying the narrative to the people. And this is a story of an India which is changing, which is transforming fundamentally from inside, which is often, I think, not understood outside, that you have new voices in the mix, new ideas, new values being propagated. Also, the old hierarchies are being challenged. So the negation of the left, the negation of the Congress Party, the center left that it represents, is, I think, a very big story of Indian political history. And 10 years, 15 years down the line, when we would look back at this moment in Indian political history, we would look at this as an inflection point, that something shifted, that BJP emerged, the center right emerged as one of the more credible voices, as a voice that perhaps represents the aspirations or was in sync with the aspirations of India much, much more than perhaps the opposition was. So you had, and this aspirational India is one which is in some ways very interestingly linked with India's idea of foreign policy, in that it wants India to do much more on foreign policy. It wants India to assert more. It wants India to play a role as a global power much more proactively. It is not satisfied with the Nehruvian idiom of non-alignment. And I'll come back to it in a bit. But I think this shift that is happening within India is almost as powerful for Indian foreign policy as the structural shift that we are witnessing in the world. The third aspect where I would locate this source of change in Indian foreign policy, and this is linked to the domestic political argument I'm making, is that the rise of new leadership in India. So at the individual level, at the personal level, we are witnessing something very interesting happening. The recent elections that happened in India saw a lot of the dynasts biting dust. The most important being Mr. Rahul Gandhi, who was defeated in his family borough of Amethi by a resounding margin. This would have been unthinkable a few years back. And I think what it represents is that the entitlement politics of the past is being negated, that you have an aspirational India which is demanding more from its leaders' performance and the sense that the leadership has to be in sync with what the ordinary Indians probably demand from them. And in that context, Modi's leadership was viewed in these elections as much more in sync with the aspirations. He was viewed as a much more decisive leader. And interestingly, is India's the first Prime Minister of India who was born post-independence. So this is also very, very important to understand, that you have now a generational shift happening in the Indian in Indian politics. And that generational shift means that a lot of the younger generation, the millennials, for example, they have no recollection with the Nehru Gandhi dynasty. So whereas my grandmother would vote for the dynasty without thinking, my father would vote with a few amount of goading and nudging. I and the generation that is coming after me would not. We are asking some of the harder questions. I think that the politics is changing, the societal context is changing, and the shift in what is expected of an Indian leadership has shifted. The expectations are different. And that means that a leadership that speaks the language of this aspirational India is going to be an important marker in terms of how Indians will make that leadership acceptable to them or not. So you're now witnessing that shift, and therefore Mr. Modi gets a lot of votes of the younger generation, despite him being on the relatively on the other side of the age equation. But I think he's able to capture some of this young vote, some of these young voters, much more easily than a seemingly young Mr. Gandhi. So there is this shift in Indian politics that I think has to be understood if one is to understand some of the issues that are on the table on Indian foreign policy, on diplomacy, and I'll come back to them. So what these three sources, structural, domestic, political, as well as individual level and shifts, would tell you is that for Indian foreign policy, this would mean four or five things, and I would elaborate on them going forward. One is that it means that India and a lot of the Indians, as I mentioned to you earlier, are looking at Indian foreign policy or want Indian foreign policy to move beyond the passive non-alignment sort of an argument to a more proactive argument of India being a leading player in the international system. And I think this was articulated by Mr. Modi, and I'm talking of Indian foreign policy's future, and a lot of future arguments are premised on what Mr. Modi did in his first term. So there is an expectation now, which I think is very fundamental, that India should play a larger, a leading role in the international system, not merely a role of a balancer. And this was very effectively articulated by the present foreign minister, who was then foreign secretary in Mr. Modi's first term, where he articulated that India needs to move away from that India needs to be playing the role of a leading power in the international system, one that shapes the global order, one that is actively engaged with the global order, rather than one which basically passively accepts what the global order is giving to India. So I think from a nation that accepts the rules that are given to India to one that actively shapes and promotes those rules, and that means that alignments are no longer the dirty word, because non-alignment for some reason made alignment a bad word in Indian politics, in Indian foreign policy. So what we have now witnessed over the last few years is that an argument that alignments are not bad, that partnerships are not bad, that it's, if you want strategic autonomy in real sense of the term, you need stronger partnerships. Stronger partnerships become a means of expanding your space for maneuver. Strong partnerships allow you greater strategic autonomy. Whereas in the past, it was the other way around, that if you have closer partnerships, they restrict your strategic autonomy. That has been turned upside down by Mr. Modi, and at least in the way that is being articulated. So I think one of the first things that one should take note of is this argument about India's shift in India's position from just being a passive player in the international system to one that actively wants to shape the global order. Now that is the second aspect here, is that this is reflected in the desire to consolidate India's leadership in India's own vicinity. So neighborhood first policy is something that Prime Minister and his ministers have been talking about a lot, both in the first term, and if you look at the swearing in ceremony where a lot of regional leaders were invited last month, is an indicator that neighborhood is going to be a priority for the government. But neighborhood which is defined differently, neighborhood that is that is reimagined almost, because now the question is that, look, SAARC, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, which had been pretty much defunct over the last few years because India and Pakistan cannot really work together, the argument became that if you cannot really give Pakistan a veto over your leadership, over your ability to have a leadership role in the neighborhood. So therefore, if SARC is not working, then let's reactivate what is called the BIMSTEC, Bay of Bengal Initiative for Technical and Economic Cooperation. Now, BIMSTEC is on the eastern frontier, India's engagement with the eastern frontier, its eastern neighbors. So you have countries like Nepal, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, but also expanding that zone. So you also involve countries like Myanmar and Thailand. So you almost reimagine your neighborhood, not simply by saying that, look, we are moving from our west to the east. The west is, of course, Pakistan, and Pakistan is not going to allow us to do anything much substantively in the neighborhood. So rather than continuing with that obstructionist policy, let's focus more on the eastern frontier. Let's reimagine our neighborhood. Let's also link up with Myanmar and Thailand, so which creates a seamless synergy with East and Southeast Asia. So there is an aspect here where almost a reconceptualization of strategic geography is happening, where Bay of Bengal becoming a geography that links India to East and Southeast Asia. And that is an important aspect of India, of the way India wants to redefine its role in the neighborhood. So while neighborhood first remains a priority, neighborhood itself gets redefined and neighborhood's expanse becomes much wider. So neighborhood is not simply South Asia and Indian Ocean region, but also East and Southeast Asia. This then brings us to the third element here, which is managing Pakistan, which has been a perennial problem. So what do you do? What are you doing to manage Pakistan, which is, even if you don't like it, it is going to be a perennial problem, and it can intrude into India in ways that India has to then deal with what Pakistan is able to do. And I think in that sense, what we have seen over the last few years is that there has been an attempt, A, to isolate Pakistan. So every public platform that is used, where the prime minister goes, has gone, where his ministers have gone, they have articulated this argument that state sponsors of terrorism need to be contained, state sponsors of terrorism need to be confronted, and it's the responsibility of multilateral organizations, multilateral platforms, where a country like Pakistan, which India blames for supporting terrorism in India, needs to be isolated. And in that, India has had some success. India has managed, for example, to do this successfully at various platforms of the UN. There is Financial Action Task Force, which is looking into India's into Pakistan's behavior vis-a-vis terrorism. India has bilaterally put pressure on India's partners to isolate Pakistan and and state sponsors of terrorism. But also, I think what changed under Modi is that India also took unilateral action. So there have been two kinds of strikes into Pakistan. One was the surgical strike and one was the airstrike. And that was an indicator that India would be willing to up the ante. So it is an interesting mix of multilateral, bilateral, and unilateral measures, which some find provocative. But as far as Indian government is concerned, this seems to, from their perspective, the argument has been that we have to use all the instrumentalities of power at our disposal to make a case to Pakistan that it cannot be business as usual. And so this has been a constant thread in India's Pakistan policy over the last at least 3 years. After the initial attempt by Mr. Modi to reach out to Pakistan when he became prime minister in his first term, it did not work out. And since then, there has been a shift towards a posture where he has been indicating that he would not continue with dialogue unless there is credible evidence of Pakistan disrupting terrorist activities. So there is that framework. And that is, I think, linked to the fourth aspect, which is in some ways the central aspect of Indian foreign policy at the moment, is how do you reconfigure relations with China? So in some ways, India's Pakistan policy is now a subset of India's China policy. And therefore, the argument becomes that if China is the most important driver in some ways for Indian foreign policy, then how can India manage this relationship, which is extremely complex, which has elements of competition, but also aspects where India has to cooperate with China on issues in the age of Mr. Trump. So you end up in a situation where the way Modi government articulated it is that, and I think we are going to see that trend continue in the second term, is there is a clarity in terms of making bilateral differences very publicly. So there is an articulation that the bilateral in the past, the argument from India was that we need to somehow isolate the problematic aspects of this relationship and focus on the positives. I think Modi government shifted this in some ways by making it clear that they do not want the problematic aspects of this relationship being sidelined. So if you see the discourse, Modi has raised the boundary dispute, the support for Pakistan, other issues, for example, lack of support for NSG or the United Nations, very publicly. And India has gone and contested a lot of these claims and counterclaims between India and Pakistan, India and China have happened. So there is this argument that the underlying differences can no longer be seen as marginal to the larger relationship, that unless these fundamental differences are reconciled, the relationship can only progress so far. There have been certain red lines that have been drawn. So there was this crisis at the India-Bhutan-China trijunction, Doklam crisis in 2017, which was a very high-profile crisis, one of the first where the two armies, after a long time, came eyeball to eyeball. And India stood its ground, despite being the weaker party. Similarly, there has been the BRI question, the question of the Belt and Road Initiative, where India was one of the first countries to publicly oppose it. And despite the fact that there was a danger of India getting isolated, no other country in the region and beyond supported India's case. But India made a point to publicly make its reservations on BRI known to China. And they have continued on that trajectory since then. Similarly, Pakistan has remained a problem, and Pakistan has been an issue which has been discussed and debated between India and China. And India had made its reservations on Pakistan very clear. But at the same time, India has also engaged China on global issues. And I think especially what has happened in the age of Mr. Trump is that Mr. Trump has in some ways brought India and China together on trade issues. If you read the speeches that the Chinese president gave and Mr. Modi gave, Indian Prime Minister gave at the Davos in 2016 and 2017, they allude to this idea that that America is challenging the fundamentals of economic globalization, and it is the responsibility of rising powers like India and China to stand up to that. So I think that has brought India and China together in some interesting ways in recent times, despite their bilateral problems. As China's footprint grows in South Asia and Indian Ocean region, the region is going to see greater contestation between China and India. And similarly, India's engagement in East and Southeast Asia is going to be much greater than in the past. Its diplomatic footprint is going to increase. And therefore, India will be taking positions on issues like South China Sea and freedom of navigation, etc., which India had been taking for the last few years. So I think as the two powers intrude into each other's what are traditionally called as the spheres of influence, there is going to be a lot more contestation visible on these areas. But at the same time, global issues, given that these two countries are on the similar upward growth trajectory, would propel them to have this conversation about the future of the global economic order at the same time. Now, this in some ways brings me to the fifth point that I want to make, is that as you look at the region, as you look at these new geographies that are being created, and one of them being the Indo-Pacific, India's role and ramping up of its profile in the Indo-Pacific is going to be another element of what will happen to Indian foreign policy in the coming years. We are going to see an India that is much more engaged in the Indo-Pacific than in the past, and India that is much more ambitious about its role in the Indo-Pacific than in the past. Now, if you see the definition that Indian Prime Minister gave of how he views Indian Indo-Pacific at the Shangri-La Dialogue last year, his was a very expansive definition, all the way from Africa to the Pacific. Now, not all countries share the definition. Especially, I think American definition is much more restrictive. But and it's still, I think these definitions, these geographical configurations are being elaborated upon. They are being discussed in various capitals in the region. But India made it clear that at least with this, you know, with this articulation, that it views Indo-Pacific as an area where it would like to have a larger footprint, but it would also like ASEAN centrality in the Indo-Pacific to be the cornerstone of its Indo-Pacific policy. And by doing that, I think what India was trying to the point that India was trying to make is that it's ultimately about the smaller states in the region. It is not so much about the big players in the region, but it is ultimately about the smaller states and their interests in the region that Indo-Pacific needs to work towards. If Indo-Pacific has to have any salience, then it is the smaller states, the regional states, the Southeast Asian states in particular, that need to be invested in this idea. And I think that allows India in some ways to take this the focus away from China and make it a much more nimble and much more interesting concept than perhaps just if you play it vis-a-vis China, then it becomes sort of a containment policy against China in some ways. So therefore, I think that the expectation is that that's something that India will continue to work towards, working with like-minded countries to deliver in third countries, I think is going to be an important part of this endeavor. So whether you're looking at connectivity and infrastructure, whether you're looking at economics and trade, and whether you're looking at security, it is very clear that India's ability to deliver remains relatively limited. So therefore, it would like to work with other countries like Japan, like Australia, like Southeast Asia, where possibly it can. So there is, for example, a lot of focus on the Middle East, and on Africa, on Southeast Asia and Indian foreign policy. Where India is expected to deliver would depend on how India can partner with other like-minded countries and in the region. And the sixth point that I think I want to make is that foreign what Mr. Modi has tried to do in the first term, and hopefully this will continue, is to make foreign policy and across the government enterprise, which is, you know, which in some ways should be par for the course, but in the Indian context, it is unique what he's been trying to do. Not looking at foreign policy in isolation, but looking at foreign policy as a driver for India's domestic transformation. And that is a message, you know, foreign policy and domestic politics policy are always related. It's a given. But I think in the past, the ability of Indian leadership to communicate to ordinary Indians as to why foreign policy matters was relatively limited. I think Mr. Modi has changed that narrative. He has been trying to make foreign policy a part of the normal sort of national conversation. And that means that foreign policy will continue to be a very, very important part of what he does going forward. He was, I have in my book termed him as a foreign policy prime minister in his first term. I'm very sure that by the time his second term ends, you know, I don't think there'll be a change in that nomenclature. I think the other aspect here is that he has also tried to use all levers of power in his operationalization of foreign policy, and there in particular I would like to add the military. So whereas on the one side you have defense diplomacy that is now much more integrally linked with India's expectations of what role it wants to play in the world, so Ministry of External Affairs and Ministry of Defense are much more coordinated than in the past, and so defense diplomacy has become a much more important aspect of India's foreign policy articulation. There is also the other thing about the use of force in Indian foreign policy. So whether we like it or not, you know, what happened earlier this year between India and Pakistan also means that use of force is now much more integral into how India views its foreign policy engagement. Connectivity and infrastructure, where you are looking at India's economic diplomacy and how it needs to be revitalized. There is an increasing awareness about the role that India can play and potentially should play in its vicinity, in its neighborhood, especially in the context where other actors are revamping their foreign policy engagement. So you have major powers now investing significantly on infrastructure and connectivity. India's economic diplomacy has not, the numbers are not there yet, but they are growing and the trajectory is very clear. I think the idea is that India's ability to deliver needs to be enhanced. And in this context, all the strategic projects have actually been under the supervision of the Prime Minister's office himself. So you have, in particular, for example, if you see the last 5 years, one of the big projects that was completed and delivered was Chabahar. The first phase of Chabahar project in Iran was delivered. Now, that was a project that was hanging in balance for quite some time. There were lots of reports that it was not being, India is not being very active in terms of delivery, as it always is. And therefore, the Prime Minister's office decided to make it a priority and delivered it on time. So there is this sense that you have the strategic logic of the infrastructure projects, connectivity projects, is now well understood, and in some ways India is going to work with other, in some situations India is going to work with other like-minded countries. In other in others, it would like to take it, for example, in South Asian Indian Ocean region, where it is on its own and where it wants to be on its own, it would like to enhance its ability to deliver on the ground, which also means that certainly you will have to shift the bureaucratic structures that prevail in the country, and that seems to me to be one of the priority areas going forward. Now, all of this means that this is going to be a very, if this is the ambition, then clearly the challenges are equally ambitious. If your foreign policy landscape is changing this rapidly, if your ambitions are evolving this rapidly, I think one of the problems in the Indian case has been that India's institutional infrastructure has not evolved that rapidly. So we don't yet have a bureaucracy that is as nimble or as adaptable to this changing environment as perhaps many in India would have liked it to be. And that is going to be this, as you know, this I think is going to be a fundamental challenge for Mr. Modi as he goes forward. Can he transform India domestically enough so that this foreign policy vision can be, his foreign policy vision can be operationalized, can be delivered? Because if he is not able to do that, then I think we can discuss all these issues in theory, but in reality, all the same problems that operate today will continue to be there. The reality remains that India's capabilities and India's capacities to deliver are still very, very limited. And as India moves forward with an ambitious foreign policy agenda, as India moves forward with this idea that that India wants to have a transformative foreign policy, it is equally important for India to have a transformative, to have a domestic domestic transformation, a transformation of domestic landscape. If the ideas that Mr. Modi puts on the table, if the ideas that Mr. Modi is trying to put on the agenda are to be realized, I think I would end there and would be happy to take questions and comments and your observations on board. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Professor. I think everybody has just been given a masterclass in Indian foreign policy. I suggest that you're suggesting that the Indian bureaucracy is not yet adapted or prepared to implement Modi's vision. Might just take your 6 points and create the structures around them. I think that could do worse. Thank you very much. So we'll now have about 15 or 20 minutes of questions and answers. So while I'm waiting for you to think about some questions you want to ask, I have a couple, and it comes off your last point about foreign policy being a whole of government enterprise, and that perhaps the infrastructure is not quite adapted to having such an ambitious enterprise. And you talked about the foreign policy which is aspirational, that India wants to play a more assertive role in the world, not to be afraid of alignments. Alignments, not a dirty word anymore. And yet, as our own research has discovered over the past decade or so, when we have gathered information about 60 countries' diplomatic networks and ranked them, but importantly behind that ranking was a fairly meticulous exercise trying to map the diplomatic networks of the most important countries of the world, which gives an idea of what their foreign policy is and how they propose to prosecute it. And yet India has always been significantly underrepresented on that data gathering exercise. It ranked 12 last time we did it. It had around 180 missions, and yet in this group of 60 OECD, G20 and Asian nations, it's the second most populous and probably will be the biggest population in the world. It has the seventh largest economy. And yet it has this tiny diplomatic network. It has around 500 overseas diplomats, which is about the same, to give you an idea, as Australia has, or in fact I think even less these days. What could India do? What could the government do to... Or is there any... do you get any sense that, the administration is aware of this deficit and plans to do anything about it? And what could it do?
I think the awareness is certainly there, and this is and this predates Mr. Modi, and we have seen this discussion about the capacity problem that India faces is this diplomatic core argument that it's smaller than countries like New Zealand or Singapore. I think this has been a continuing thread in the engagement on this issue. The challenge, of course, is that if I recall correctly, our former Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh, when he had come to office, immediately after that he had suggested that lateral entry, and the bureaucracy just scuttled it, the idea, and we never heard about it again. And I think the problem, therefore, is that if you can mobilize, how do you make sure that that you are getting the best talent, at the same time you are also expanding the scope of your service, foreign service, in this case, foreign service. Now, what we have seen in the past few years is that it's incredibly difficult for weak prime ministers to do it. But it's also incredibly difficult for strong prime ministers to do it. Mr. Modi was not able to do much. I think what symbolically he did in his last year in office was to open the, not foreign policy bureaucracy, but bureaucracy in general, to lateral entry. There were a few appointments that were made at the joint secretary level. And I think he insisted on it, despite a lot of criticism that he got from certain sections of the establishment. And now the reports are that since that was accomplished, and now I think there is there are around 900 director level appointments being made in the Indian government through lateral entry. Now, how that, because this is a new experiment India would be doing, and India is of course also very proud of its bureaucracy because it has, with all its problems, it has also done some good. So you are now in a situation where you have to use this best talent that is available to you. You have to bring it into a system which is incredibly resistant to change, and you have to make sure that your agenda is fructified, that it is that you achieve something out of it. So I think I would be watching it very with a great degree of interest. I don't know whether, I mean, clearly he's going all out, and I think bureaucratic reforms is very big on his agenda. But whether he is able to, because 5 years is a small, short time to figure out. If you bring in these people, if you have lateral entry, if you bring in fresh blood into the system, it may be that in the first shot it may not work, or it can have a blowback effect that you would rue the decision. So I think it needs to be watched carefully what happens. But that is an attempt to solve exactly this kind of a problem, because you now are in a situation where issues like you have projects which are now being managed by foreign policy bureaucracy, which has no expertise in project management. The infrastructure projects are being managed by bureaucracy, which has no expertise in how you manage these things. So I think we are now moving towards a system where, or we seem to be moving towards a system where the Prime Minister is driving a lot of these changes. Some of these changes are being resisted at the bottom. And I think at the end of this contestation, something will come out. I don't know whether it's really positive or negative, so I can't answer that. But clearly, the recognition is there. There is an attempt to change the way we also train our foreign policy bureaucrats, foreign policy recruits. So that is happening, but it is happening at a level which I don't think does justice to the kind of, the scale and scope of your transformative agenda that you've brought on board. So that's the problem, that the two are not in sync, hopefully with this kind of mandate, you will be able, I hope Mr. Modi will be able to push some of these big
the bigger challenges which come with their own costs. But bureaucratic reforms, I personally am not very optimistic about.
Do you subscribe to the idea that it actually is important? I mean, do you believe in a diplomatic network and a diplomatic corps in order to prosecute a foreign policy, or is it, you know, in a digital age that, you know, diplomacy is from embassy, doesn't really matter, it can be done just as effectively, you know, from a headquarters in New Delhi?
No, I think we need a diplomatic corps which is nimble enough, which is trained on issues which I think are the requirement of the day, you know, because a lot of our training is also very lopsided. The sort of transformations that are happening, and I think, again, the across the government approach, if you are taking on these questions, you need people who are not only trained economists, trained project managers, trained environmental scientists. When you're negotiating, with some of the best scientists across the world, you have to have some ability to decipher what is going on. And I think most of the times we find that a lot of our training is not in sync with those requirements. So I hope, that change happens. But it will have to happen much faster than I think what is happening at the moment.
Thank you, Harsh, for a very insightful talk. I'm Natasha. I'm working with a corporate advisory firm called Newland Global Group, and we work primarily on Australia-India bilateral ties. I was earlier working for the Indian Parliament for the last 12 years. My question to you, Harsh, in this dynamic global order, do you really think that competition and cooperation can coexist, especially in relation to China? Because India-China relations are largely driven by trust deficit, by suspicion. And is that the reason that we are extremely cautious in engaging ourselves with Australia because of Australia's relation with China?
Yes, I mean, see, that has always been this question about where does India fit in, and why doesn't India take a clear position on certain issues? I think if one is looking at the trajectory of Sino-Indian relations, it's very clear where the trajectory is going. What it means for bilateral relationship. I don't think anyone who has witnessed last 5 years would say that, you know, it's a relationship that is still being made. It's a relationship that is most of the pieces of the puzzle are in place. The question, I think, for India is of one of tactical maneuvering versus strategic partnerships. And I think tactically you have to maneuver around the fact that the world is very dynamic. So there is often this question asked as to why, for example, if you're looking at the Sino-US contestation happening, where does India fit in? Now, clearly, anyone who looks at the elements of Indo-US engagement and Sino-Indian engagement would tell you that the story is actually one-sided. There is, as you point out, there is trust deficit with the Chinese. There's so many problems with the Chinese. There are fundamental structural conflicts with the Chinese that it's very difficult to see them as strategic partners. What you have are tactical partnerships where, for example, Mr. Trump comes in and he makes life very difficult for China and India on economic order. So there are these partnerships that will emerge on these issues. Similarly, I would say that you also have a situation where you have Indo-Russia partnership, which is much talked about. People get very worked up. Why India continues to buy with the Russians, and why doesn't India become more vocal with the Russians? But there is a history with Russia as far as India is concerned. And if you look at the fundamentals of Indo-Russian relationship, there is hardly anything there. You know, the economics, the numbers are not there. There's hardly any trade happening. There is no people-to-people contact. What we have is a defense relationship of a particular kind, historical in nature, but also in ways where every few years you would have one big deal being signed with the Russians to keep them happy. But beyond that, nothing much is happening on the Indo-Russian front. So the issue therefore becomes that whether you are doing, you know, this tactical maneuvering, what kind of costs it imposes on you. And I think now with Mr. Trump, there are certain kinds of costs that are going to be imposed on you. He is all for transactionalism. He does not, you know, the logic that India was tried to underscore in the past was that you just have to look at the big picture. If you look at the big picture, Indo-US relations can never go wrong. But I think he is more interested in here and now. What can India deliver for the US now? And I think there are questions around that which are being impacted upon. And I think that is where this question becomes interesting as to what will happen over the next 5 to 6 years as India navigates its way in a system which is incredibly in flux, which is an incredible flux. And I think for the US, also this is a question that that India looks at the US with some degree of wariness. If you recall, during the first few years of Obama administration, in fact, the first year of Obama administration, there was a lot of talk of G2, that a global condominium of US and China can manage world affairs. And I think that generated a sense of paranoia in India as well, that look, tomorrow these two superpowers can come to an agreement on something and we will be left behind. So is it in India's interest to side with the Americans at this point? Similarly, now many in India would question whether if tomorrow Mr. Trump signs a deal with Beijing, then India would be left high and dry. So where does India fit in? And so if everyone is hedging, then India also has to hedge in some ways. So I think some amount of hedging is part of the structural environment that we face. But if you look at it structurally, if you look at the fundamentals of these engagements, you would find that there's a certain logic that is very difficult to miss.
Thank you, Professor. You mentioned that India's success in Indo-Pacific depends on the government's ability to partner with countries like Australia. Do you think that an India-Australia free trade agreement can play a part in this process? And can this have an effect on strengthening the quadrilateral dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is no doubt that economic relationship between Australia and India needs to be upgraded. I think it is going well, but I think it has not reached the potential that many, both in Canberra and in New Delhi would like, many in capital cities would like. But with free trade, agreements, my sense, India is so bad at free trade agreements. I mean, we have not signed a free trade agreement in decades, and our ability to conclude these agreements remain very, very insignificant at the moment. I think there is a lot of there is no domestic political space or capital for reaching these agreements. Now, one can be very optimistic and one can say, look, Mr. Modi has this mandate, perhaps he will move forward very fast with some of these things. But I very much doubt whether the domestic political economy in India whether that domestic political economy itself is an obstacle in the way one looks at these free trade agreements, and I think at the moment there is very little appetite for reaching those agreements. So rather than making a free trade agreement the end game, maybe something else can be worked out where the economic relationship can be enhanced, which seems to me to be a better way of upgrading the economic side of the engagement rather than going directly for the free trade agreement. But Quad, I think the issue of Quad, I'm an optimist on Quad, and the sheer fact that it almost died in 2007, then it was resurrected in 2017, tells you a certain story about the world order. That in 2007 we all thought now it's done and dusted. In 2017 it came back, and we are talking of Quad again. I think tells you a story that structural factors have a much stronger role in the way institutions are created and in the way institutions are maintained than we often give them credit for. So if it were not for the rise of China or for some of the other structural tensions in the region, the Quad would never have been resurrected. But the fact that it is there now is positive. But what can it do in the present circumstances, once again, where I think all of us are grappling with this challenge, all four countries are grappling with this challenge of navigating between a rising China and an America that has its interests, that is redefining its interests, that is articulating its interests differently. And so, between the economic thrust of the Chinese engagement and the security thrust of the US engagement, how do you navigate this? I think becomes an important vantage point in terms of how all four parts of the squad are looking at the squad and this engagement. And therefore, it is not surprising that, you know, the softer issues are being talked about. Infrastructure is being talked about. You know, the first meeting of Quad talked about infrastructure engagement, which is, I think, very important. I'm saying it is soft, but I think actually infrastructure engagement is going to be the defining aspect of the Indo-Pacific as China moves forward with BRI. And other countries come up with their own individual infrastructure connectivity projects. I think some kind of a calibration between the four Quad countries is going to be very important. But where I think it would still be relatively weak is on hard security. Where I think what is happening is that bilaterally and trilaterally, if you take different elements of the Quad, they're working very well. So bilateral Indo-Japanese engagement, bilateral India-Australia engagement. We were just having this discussion about the sort of military exercises that have been India and Australia have been completely, it is now on a completely different trajectory than it used to be just a few years back. So I think the scale and scope of those engagements is much more substantive. So bilaterally, trilaterally, I think it's much easier to do the kind of engagements, and it's politically more feasible to do those kind of engagements than at the Quad level. So I think if you break down Quad into different segments, you are witnessing great engagements. But as a Quad, where the Quad at a formal level will move into something on hard security in the short to medium term, I very much doubt that.
Thank you, Professor. In your closing remarks, you mentioned the ability to prosecute foreign policy goals depend on domestic successes. I wonder if you could just provide a review on what's been achieved in the first Modi term and what are the headline successes?
Oh, of course, challenge to do that in about the minute that we've got left.
Well, I would just say that I think there was a lot of criticism of Mr. Modi in the first term. That is on the economic front, for example, there was an argument that Mr. Modi has not been able to deliver on big ticket reforms. Although he had the GST bill passed or insolvency bill passed, but there were no other big ticket items. For example, disinvestment was not there, etc., etc. There was a lot of criticism around that. I think where perhaps he has been transformative is on the micro issues of microeconomic issues of micromanagement of policy decisions. So I think if you look at what he has been able to accomplish with sanitation, in rural areas, in terms of providing cooking gas to the rural women population, that has been his success stories, and that allowed him to get the kind of mandate he got in his second term. Because a lot of I think of us sitting in Delhi were not reading this, the impact that his policies are having at the micro level. And I think some of these policies really had an impact at the level where you are financial inclusion. So the opening of bank accounts for people below a certain economic threshold. That I think a very remarkable transformation in the way those people have looked at governance and governments. And that has given him that space in domestic politics, which is quite I think, extraordinary in Indian politics. We don't get it, but I think that's the way Indian politics has evolved. He has sort of redefined the political economy of governance in India. So rather than now looking at the big sort of issues around big ticket reforms, one will have to assess him based on what he does in terms of delivery, last mile delivery, as he calls it. So I think there is also now in the second term, the first priority that he has made is piped water to each and every individual. By 2020, he wants to give a house and electricity to every village in India. So I think those are the sort of micro-level issues, economic issues, that perhaps has been his success stories in the first term. And hopefully he wants to make them success stories in the second term as well.
We'll have to wrap it up there. I thank you very much, Professor Pant, for coming and talking to us. India is certainly now on Australia's agenda in a way that it wasn't even at the beginning of your Prime Minister's first term. When we asked Australians in the 2014 Lowy Institute poll, I think, how many of them had heard of Professor Modi among other Asian leaders, and there were only about 40% who had. So things have certainly changed, and I think you've described why. Thank you very much for coming today and sharing your insights. It's been a pleasure to have you.